Welcome to Luxury Leaders Podcast, episode number two with Michele Grosso from the Langham in Boston. Michele's been at the Langham almost 4.5 years, and he's a great leader. I've heard nothing but great things about him, and I've loved the other conversations we've had so far. I think you guys will really enjoy learning about Michele and how he leads. And welcome, Michele.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Brendan.
So, Michele, you told me earlier your dad was a GM for a hotel.
Yeah, my dad spent his whole career in hotels from, I believe, age 11 or 14, depending which version of the story he's telling. And as a child, I actually lived in a hotel in South Africa for about 4 years. It wasn't quite Eloise at the Plaza, but it was a good place to grow up. And he always said that he wanted his children to get real jobs and not work in hotels. And somehow my brother and my sister listened to him, but I didn't. So I joined the business.
And you guys lived in various countries growing up, correct?
Yeah, predominantly Italy, England, and South Africa.
Which of those was your favorite?
You know, it's hard to say. Italy was when I was really young, so I didn't remember too much of it. But certainly, I loved living in England and the UK. I lived in London, and South Africa was a great memory in my teen years. So both were wonderful.
Great. And what's the best memory you have seeing your dad work at a hotel that really inspired you to take his footsteps?
I'm not sure I'd call it the best memory, but whenever my report card came out at the end of each semester, I had to take it down and present it to him in his office. And it was definitely a memory. I'm not sure it was a great one, but he quizzed me as if he was interviewing me for a job. So I always remember that.
So you'd have the whole panel there, not just your dad.
he had questions for me, normally about why wasn't I top at everything, but yes.
So that gave you experience in presenting to a board.
Yeah, it certainly did.
Fantastic. And how did you start? You know, I know you lived in hotels. How did you what made you decide, I want to do this for the rest of my life?
You know, it's funny when I was just before my 16th birthday, my dad told me it was time to get a part-time job, and I didn't fancy doing a newspaper around like a lot of my friends. So I got hired at McDonald's, and at those days I couldn't work in the kitchen; I was too young. So I just cleaned the public areas, and that led to what was an upgrade at the time to Pizza Hut, and working there in the kitchen. And when I was about 17. I was studying French in London at school, and all my friends from school went and lived with a family for the summer and in France, and I didn't really fancy that. And so my dad helped me get a job at a hotel in Paris, and I was a commis in the restaurant. I helped breakfast service and lunch service, and I did that for a whole summer. And after that, I didn't want to do anything else. So that's what started it.
So you started in the kitchen.
I was a commis in the restaurant, a commis du rang in the restaurant.
Oh, in the restaurant. Okay. And then what was your first job outside of the restaurant in a hotel?
My first job outside the restaurant was when I was a couple of years later, I was in Germany at a hotel working in a restaurant. And the chef at there, I don't know, for some reason took a liking to me and said I should come and work in the kitchen with him. And I moved over and did that for a year and a half. And that was a fantastic experience.
And at what point did you realize, you know what, this is going to be my career?
You know, I at those early stages, I think when I was working in the kitchen, I was around 21. I was just always, what's the next opportunity early on? And so at that hotel, I had the opportunity to also work later on in the front desk and concierge. And at some point, I decided, you know, I should probably try and get a job as a manager somewhere. And I applied to a few hotels in London, all leading hotels, and I applied to them all. And I wanted to get into stewarding because back then they were saying, you know, that's the housekeeping of F&B. That's where you learn how to manage and motivate people. And so I applied for that position at at all six leading hotels at the time. And some of the hotels were a little small. They didn't have the role, but I did get offered a few interviews. I traveled to London. I interviewed at some famous hotels. Some called it the back of house manager. Some called it assistant chief steward. And one hotel turned me down outright and said they didn't have the job for me. And I don't take rejection very well. So I went to the employee entrance of that hotel, knocked on the door, spoke to security, asked if I could speak to someone in human resources, got a courtesy interview, and it led to three others. And by the end of the last interview, they actually offered me the job as assistant chief steward, which they said they didn't have in the beginning. But they I guess created it for me, and I joined them, and I ended up spending 29 years with that company. So I'm glad I knocked on that door.
Was that the Four Seasons?
I was the Four Seasons in London, which back then was called the Inn on the Park in London.
Okay, so what was going on through your mind at this time? You'd just been rejected. Why didn't you just say okay and give up?
You know, I at least wanted to understand why. And it was kind of, we don't have a job for you. And I wanted to understand why. And on top of that, my father had told me he knew the reputation of the general manager there. And he said he's a great one to work for, to learn from. And those two things just made me want to go and knock on that door. And I've shared that story with many people since, saying, you know, if you want something, don't give up at the first no. Give it another try.
That's great words of wisdom, because a lot of times in life we get rejections and we just kind of take it and don't try again and give up. So it's a true testament to not take a no for an answer. I like it. Have there been other points in your life where you kind of did that again and it worked out for you?
Well, I will say I can only ever remember once being told that I wasn't doing a good job, and if I continued, I wouldn't have a job. And that was my very first job at McDonald's. One of the managers sat down with me and said, you know, you're really not doing a good job. You're chatting too much with everyone. And if this keeps up, you know, we're going to have to let you go. And that was a huge wake up call. And I made it kind of one of my things in life. I didn't want to have that conversation again. And fortunately, many years later, I still haven't had that conversation again. And I hope that remains that way.
Well, it seems like, you know, that kind of was one of your strengths, though, because you are a people person. But you're not supposed to talk in class or at work, I guess, too much.
I definitely was doing, I was enjoying work way too much. And whenever my friends came in to eat at that McDonald's, I was happy to drop everything and chat with them. So lesson learned.
I assume you still do that to this day when guests come in, you drop everything that, you know, get previous guests that you recognize, you go and chat with them.
Certainly. You know, I think if you're not a people person, or you don't at least enjoy, interactions, it's really not the industry for you, because both guests and obviously all your team or your colleagues, you definitely need to have ongoing conversations and communication. So it's definitely not an industry for people who don't like that.
Let's talk about your was your dad your biggest mentor growing up, or was there another one that stands out as well?
You know, I've just been fortunate to work for a lot of different great people, but I one that would stand out to me was my second Four Seasons job was opening the Four Seasons Milano, and I was a restaurant manager. And there was a hotel manager there, Patrizio Cipollini, who unfortunately has passed away. And I worked split shifts. So in theory, I had the afternoon off and started out by drinking coffee and playing chess with colleagues. And he said to me one day, well, you got that time on your hand, let's make use of it. And he had me in the office translating menus into English. He wasn't handy in those days on a computer. So he had me sit at a computer and input menus and budgets, and he'd be like, okay, change it to that number and see what happens. And he certainly taught me a lot about a lot of different things. And so I definitely would include him, but just over the years, I've worked for very many, very smart and competent people. And you pick things up from everyone.
How do you now pay that forward to people that you mentor?
I think, you know, as opportunities arise, I don't feel like mentoring is, I'm going to sit with you once every 6 months and have a chat and ask how you're doing. I think mentoring is just ongoing. It might be a word in the ear as things happen after someone's done something. You know, it's a combination of encouragement and, you know, you could always try this or you could always try that. But I just feel like that just never stops. And it's probably the part of the job I enjoy the most.
Tell me about your favorite success story without, I'm sure you can't give away a name, or maybe you can, I don't know, of someone who was going in the complete wrong way and you were able to, with your coaching and mentorship, and put your arm around them and made them into a success.
Okay, I won't any names, but a number of years back, I was a food and beverage director, and I had a restaurant manager and a restaurant chef that were going at it very loudly in the kitchen. Their pans weren't flying, but it was getting there. And it wasn't the first time. It was the first time I experienced it. And I had to, I think it was a borderline discipline thing, but it wasn't really a discipline meeting. It was you need to figure this out because everyone's watching you and they'll follow you and you'll have the whole kitchen against the restaurant team before you know it. And I had to speak to both of them. And I've got to say that, you know, they both turned it around in ongoing conversations, but I had totally forgotten about it. And the restaurant manager many years later reminded me of that. Do you remember when you had to sit down with us and tell us how to behave? I had forgotten about it. I said, oh yeah. And I both continue to have a great careers, and certainly not because of me, but certainly avoided having to do anything drastic with either of them by getting them on the right path.
So you're a peacemaker as well, then.
Oh, I think that's part of the role as well. You're a peacemaker, but sometimes you've got to stir it up as well. You know, you got to get people, you know, excited and emotional. It's an emotional business. You got to love what you do. So sometimes you're making the peace and sometimes you're doing the opposite. You're trying to stir it up to get some reaction, get some life out of people.
To kind of motivate and inspire them.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Let's go back to, how have you been able to manage, you know, being in the moment, doing your job now, but also having that eye for the future of where you want your career to go and how to grow that? And what advice do you have for people in a similar situation who are maybe trying to be a first-time GM, or maybe they are a GM and want to get to the next step?
You know, I think the best advice I can give anyone that I got given, and it sounds so simple, is there's only one person in charge of your career, and that's you. You need to manage it yourself. You need to seek out conversations. You need to tell people what you want. I sincerely think this is probably one of the best pieces of advice I was ever given by an incredible gentleman, Christian Clerk, who went on to become president of Four Seasons at one point. He said to me, you would imagine that everyone knows what you want, no matter whether you're having a conversation with a family member, a guest, someone you work for, or a travel agent that you would like them to send you business. But it is so powerful when you can say to somebody, you know what? I really want your business. I really want that job. It sounds so simple, but it's amazing how often maybe that doesn't come across. Maybe people think you're not 100% sure you want to do that job. But ending a conversation clearly stating what you would hope to happen, what you would like to happen, is a great thing to do, because it ends a conversation with a very clear message, shows how much you want whatever you're asking for. And it's advice he gave me, and I try and remind myself of it all the time at the end of a conversation. Is it clear what I want following this conversation? And sometimes you realize afterwards I wasn't being clear. I might have been talking too much. And so to end it with a summary of saying, please send me your business. I really want to take care of your clients. It can go a long way.
That makes me think of a lot of times we don't know what we want personally. How do you do that introspection to figure out what is it that you want before you can then communicate that to other people?
Yeah, that's a difficult one. I'm sure there's been many times in my career where I've not been entirely sure. Or maybe I hit a crossroad where I was given two options. Do you want to go here and do this job, or do you want to go there and do that job? And at the time, it was fantastic. I was in Milan, and I was given the option to go to Istanbul and be an assistant food and beverage director, or go to Singapore and be a director of outlets. And one was a slightly better title, arguably. But well, which one do I want to do? And I hadn't been to either places. You kind of think through, and at the end, I chose one. I didn't do eeny, meeny, miny, mo. I almost did. I try to inform myself as much as I could of the destinations, and just decided the biggest adventure would be to go to Singapore. And at that time, I wasn't tied down to anywhere in particular, so I chose that. But sometimes you take a leap of faith, or you it might be someone you've spoken to who you think, yeah, that's who I want to work for next, and that's what helps you get to that final decision. But I certainly haven't always had the answers, that's for sure.
Well, that's a great reminder to anyone thinking of changing jobs or going to something new, is what you just said. You got to make an informed decision, do your research, talk to people, get other people's perspective and point of view. And that can help alleviate some of the unknowns and uncertainty.
Yeah, it certainly can. It certainly can. And it also helps you be prepared for when you actually arrive wherever you're going, to what to expect. Because if you're going to a different country with a different language and a different culture, it's easy to say, well, I'll just go and live there. And going to work's the easiest thing. To go to work in a hotel is the easiest thing. It's life outside that you have to organize. How am I going to connect my utilities? How am I going to, all those kind of things that you just don't know how it's going to work. So trying to get as much information. If you can find someone who's worked in that location, even for another company or anything, that can help. Although I always think you shouldn't make your decision just based on one person's opinion. They might have had a bad or an exceptionally good experience, but at least it's more data, if you will, to help you make your final decision.
And that brings another topic, work-life balance. How do you, keep from getting burned out, if that's even, maybe it's something you love your job so much, or you don't get burned out ever, but how do you balance that?
That's an interesting thing. Obviously, the industry's changed much, and rightfully so, over the last years. And those badges of honors of, well, I worked this many hours today. Well, I worked that many, so I'm, better than you. That is thankfully mostly behind us. And if someone's worked 16 hours a day, I'd be asking, well, what went wrong? What's not working? Because that's not meant to happen. Personally, what I try and do is I always try and have a next something planned. It could be a vacation, could be a weekend away, could be a great meal, something. I always have that planned so that I don't let 6 months go by and realize, gosh, I'm tired, I haven't done anything. Having those things to look forward to in the future, they help motivate you. If you're having a bad few minutes, thinking about them can cheer you up. But it also just reminds you that if you don't schedule certain things, they won't happen. And you need to make sure that that you schedule them. You need to have those on the horizon.
That is great advice, because I've seen that in my life too. If it's always going to be someday, or in a few months, or And that never comes if you don't write it down in the calendar and actually, you know, book the trip.
Yeah.
You spoke of vacations. Where's your favorite place to go to vacations, or where was your last most exciting vacation?
It's hard to have favorites. It feels like picking between your children. I certainly love my father still alive and in Italy, so I love to go back and visit him there. But some of the recent places I've been that I really, really enjoyed were Colombia. And I actually, in the end, finally went to Istanbul, even though I didn't go and work there many years ago. So those are certain places I'd love to revisit at some point. But love going back to Italy.
Are you able to fully shut down and enjoy vacation and not think of work when you're on vacation?
You know, I actually, at some stage in my career, that was always my goal on vacation. And I realized when I came back, the amount of catch up I had and also the worry I had when I was on vacation, I hope everything's okay. And I've now learned that when I wake up, I'm an early riser long before my wife. And so if I wake up at 5:30 or 6 in the morning on vacation and I go in and I read all my emails or respond to a few, only the ones that absolutely need it, I have a much better vacation because I don't worry because now I know what's going on. And when I go back, I need about 2 hours with a closed door and I'm fully caught up. And so it's kind of funny that by working a little bit on vacation, I enjoy my vacation a lot more. I don't know if that makes sense, but it certainly works for me.
On one hand, you're right. It is a little counterintuitive, but I see the benefit of if there's any fires, you know that you've taken care of those and don't have to worry. So then you can get those out of the way and then focus on being here and now and present. And yeah, awesome. So you spoke about being an early riser. Do you have a certain morning routine that you do religiously or?
Yeah, you know, beyond just, you know, shaving and getting ready, the one thing I do every morning is I have one of those, I don't know if you know the Bialetti, those Italian mocha things that you put water and coffee in and you put on the stove and you make your, mine's a 6 cup of espresso and I drink half of it and my wife drinks the other half. And every morning, doesn't matter if I have to be in at 4:30 for something that's happening in the hotel, I will always get up early enough to sit and have 10 minutes while I sip my coffee. And it's funny, that is when I go and visit my dad, my best 10 minutes when I'm visiting my dad are in the morning. We'll get up and we'll make a pot of coffee and we'll just sit at the table. And he has these beautiful old cafe latte cups. And I just sit there and drink coffee with him. And it's just, that's something if I had to skip that, I think it'd mess my whole day up.
I can 100% relate. I'm first thing I do in the morning is drink my coffee. If I don't have it, my day is completely out of whack. So, tell me about how did you get your current role at the Langham, and what's been your biggest challenge?
You know, it's funny, Brendan. I was, I spent 29 years with Four Seasons and loved every minute and was convinced I would have bet serious money that when I retired, there would be a Four Seasons tree on my business card in my last job. I was convinced. And I got a call, as you get, and I told the person not to waste their time, that I was more than happy, but if they had a role that they needed someone for, I might know someone looking, and they were a little insistent and said, just have one conversation. Well, you know, what can it hurt? I was like, okay, you're wasting everyone's time, but why not? And that one conversation, I think, led to 6 or 7. At the end of it, there was an amazing renovation project at the Langham in Boston, which ended up taking 2.5 years and costing like $200 million. And it was unlike anything I'd ever done. I had done plenty of room refurbs and things like that, but nothing on this scale. And it really excited me. And there was also a certain amount of autonomy in doing it. And the other really important thing is, I think it's so important who you report to. Your job satisfaction will be more affected by who you work for, who you report to, than anything else. And I had a wonderful connection with the gentleman I ended up reporting to, Bob Vandenort, who was regional out of London, but for the Americas. And he's now currently our CEO. He got promoted last year, but I felt a connection to him that those things made me think about it. And I went home and I said to my wife, you know what? I might actually take this job. And I did. So that's what made me pick it. What got me the job, you'd have to ask Bob because he offered it to me. But it certainly was a combination of the chemistry with the people I spoke to, and the excitement of a renovation on a scale I had not seen before. So that was a very long answer to your first part of your question. Biggest challenge, I think you'll hear it again and again in the industry, is recruitment, is finding good people and keeping them. There's just, you know, doesn't seem to be enough talent out there. And there are so many amazing job opportunities that when you have someone who's good, you know, in the past we might have said, oh, they need to do this job for this amount of time to gain the experience for the next role. That no longer works. That no longer works. If you don't give the person that job and that title when they're, I don't know, 70% ready, 60% ready, someone else will. And so you really just have to look at people and say, okay, they have the potential. You know, do we have enough of a support system to get them that last remaining 25, 30, 40%? And if you do, you've got to give them a chance, because otherwise someone else will offer them the job and you'll lose them anyway. So recruitment, retention, and taking a leap of faith on a lot of people, is a challenge, but it's also what our industry is about these days. So that's what you embrace.
So there's obviously a risk that you take whenever bringing a new person on, and how do you mitigate that risk?
Well, it's funny, you know, anyone you hire from the outside is a risk as well, right? You are hiring someone based on a series of interviews. I don't know, let's say someone went through a couple of hours in interviews. You're going to hire them based on that and their resume and their references. And if you've worked with someone for 18 months and you, or a year or even 6 months, and you've seen what they can do, I would argue that's still less of a risk because you know more about that person. You know more about their strengths and weaknesses. And if you know what their weaknesses are, maybe you can put a plan in place to help with that. So I think it's a risk, but it's a calculated one based on good information. So I would never do it if I really wasn't sure they could succeed. I wouldn't want to put someone in that position. I would then just spend the time trying to explain to them what they need to do to get there and put a plan in place to help them get there. But if you're that unsure, then I wouldn't take the risk.
Let's say you have two people neck and neck that you're interviewing for a role. How do you decide which one to go with?
I think ultimately the final thing is you're looking at personality, attitude. I've always believed someone with a great attitude, you can teach them anything, but you could have the longest resume in the world, and if your attitude's not there, I can't teach you anything, you're not going to be successful in the role. So you might be for a period of time, but at some point that's going to stop. So ultimately what will push it across the finish line will be, I mean, looking at that personality, that attitude, and think how will they be with the rest of the team? Will they fit with the rest of the team? Or do I see potential clashes along the way? It doesn't mean everyone has to be best friends, by all means. But you want to make sure you're not going to upset the kind of the balance on the team, the chemistry on the team.
Got it. Now let's rewind a little bit about what you said about the challenge of the renovation. It was exciting for you that they were doing at the Ling in Boston. Tell me about that renovation. What was exciting about it for you, and how did it turn out?
So, it was in many ways a gut job. All the guest rooms were just gutted, 312 guest rooms gutted. most of the public space is gutted, with the exception of a couple of historic rooms, and because it's a 100-year-old building.
No, it's the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston, correct?
It's the it opened in 1922, the Federal Reserve Bank. So that was what excited me about it. And you know, 6 months in, the pandemic happened. So that was, you know, something that was not anticipated. It added to supply chain issues. All construction was stopped in Boston for 4.5 months in the middle of it. You know, and we had things coming from all over the world, marble from Italy, supplies from China, marble in particular. I remember, obviously, the pandemic hit Europe before the US, and we wanted to know if the marble for our bathrooms had been shipped. Well, all of a sudden, the company went silent on us, and we didn't know if it was still in the quarry, if it was in the port, or if it was on a boat. And we just didn't find anything out for about 2.5 months. So those were all unanticipated challenges. And on top of it, it's a 100-year-old building. You start opening up walls. We didn't find any gold left by the Federal Reserve Bank, but we found some surprises along the way, which added scope to the project. So it went from what was meant to be a 1-year project to a 2.5-year project, partially because of the pandemic and partially because the scope changed because of what was found. So that was certainly made it challenging.
Did I hear you right? You said you found gold?
No, I wish we had. We didn't.
Okay.
No, it's just the first thing I get asked. You know, you open up old walls in an old bank. People are like, did you find anything?
Okay.
No, nothing at all.
Got it. That would have been a lot cooler if you did, huh?
I wish I had found something. No, the most exciting thing we found was a really old Coca-Cola bottle that had been left in between a wall by some contractor 50 years ago. So it was a vintage bottle of Coca-Cola. I think that was the most exciting thing we found.
Is that up in the Langham now?
Should be in a museum somewhere, probably.
Yeah. So you finished the renovation finally after, how long did it take total?
2.5 years.
2.5 years. And now tell me about the product that you have that you get to work out of.
Well, you know, I've got to say it turned out beautifully. Really, really did turn out beautifully. And one of my favorite memories was when we finally did open, I spent a lot of time in the lobby the first few days. And as guests came to check in who had stayed there before the renovation, to see the reaction from them, because I actually didn't see the hotel before. I joined after it had been gutted. And so to see the reaction on their face was kind of said it all. To see how excited they were, how surprised they were. A lot of them were trying to figure out, well, what used to be here and what used to be there. And just to see that excitement was wonderful. And also, we filled about half our jobs with people who came back after the renovation to work here. When we closed, our HR director did a wonderful job. You know, Robin, she did a wonderful job calling hotels that were opening at that time to saying, we have great people, you should hire them. And she put on classes to write your resume, interview classes for people, and off people went. And some loved where they went to, had continued on in their career and were very happy. But a lot said, well, we'll come home when you reopen. And so also to see those, you know, 140, 150 employees come back, and their reaction to seeing the finished product as well was lovely. It was absolutely lovely.
Well, it's from everything I've heard, I haven't been there yet personally, but I hear it's a magical looking environment now, and you guys are doing a lot of things right.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things, you know, it was an old bank and it turned into a hotel in 1981. The Meridian in Boston back in the days. And obviously when you change the use of a building, you at that moment, you don't want everyone to think of it as a bank. So a lot was done to make sure everyone realized it's no longer a bank. And then you fast forward to, you know, 2020, 2019, 2020, when we're doing the renovation, it was a good time there to really celebrate the history of the building. So a lot was done to try and show guests that the history of the building. So little touches throughout the building, in the restaurant, there are portraits of some of the original presidents of the bank, but done in a fun kind of way. The rugs in the lobby, no guest will know unless we tell them, but the pattern around the rugs is from a $1 bill. But it's not until you pull out your $1 bill and you look, oh yeah, it's that pattern. Little touches, very subtle. In the guest room, all the furniture is designed around the steam trunks that people traveled with in the 1920s. And little leather, handles instead of your traditional handles, little studs on the side of the furniture, just to show that history. So that was a lot of fun to be able to kind of look back, and it was the right time to now say, we used to be a bank. In the restaurant, actually, there's this beautiful original terrazzo floor that was under a carpet. And when that was pulled up, we're like, let's just restore this floor. It even has the original seal of the bank stamped into it. So a lot of fun kind of looking back at the history of the building and being able to show that to our guests and share it with them. A lot of them will ask, well, you know, this was a Federal Reserve Bank. What's still original? Can we go and see it? A lot of fun with that.
But the energy too of the building and just the atmosphere is incredible.
Yeah, there's certainly, to open a hotel is a wonderful thing. It can be exhausting, but it's a wonderful feeling. And this was really like a new opening, even though it was a reopening 2.5 years later. And the teamwork and energy that goes into it. I have memories of, this big semi pulled up on the street. It couldn't fit in our loading dock. And it was full of, I think, 600 banquet chairs. And everyone was busy, getting the hotel ready. We only moved into the building 5 days before we opened because of permits. So it was a mad rush. And this semi pulled up and everyone's busy. And so I said to the hotel manager and the director of security, do you think the three of us can unload it? Let's just do it. So we went out and we started unloading this truck. And the word spread through the hotel. And before you know it, there were 25, 30 people there all wanting to help. To be honest, too many. Everyone was getting in everyone's way. But that spirit, no one asked them to help. They just all came to help. People from the laundry, from the kitchen, from everywhere, housekeeping. And that kind of spirit, gets you through the opening. But I'm really happy to say that, 2.5 years after opening or more, we still have it there. And anyone who joins the team now, that's what they join. So they just take that on themselves. So it's kind of, it's been a lot of fun just to be around that. And energy, that was the right word you used. It's just energy.
So you definitely have each other's backs and
oh yeah,
it's about the team and not the individual.
Oh yeah. My hotel manager recently left us for a great GM job that he got. And on his last day, we were gathering photos together of him doing different things around the hotel. It was so fun. It was a reminder of how many different things he had done, how many times he'd put on an apron and gloves or grabbed a broom or stood in the laundry or whatever it was. It was just a good reminder of what it took to reopen the hotel.
That's awesome. How do you build and cultivate that sense of team within your employees?
I think you first of all, it's just about who you hire, right? It really is. It goes back to that attitude and personality. If you've hired the right people, hopefully this will happen. And then you got to hire the right leaders. And most of our management team was new reopening. We had a core of managers that stayed on, but most were new. And some of the managers, I hired a bar manager, and she said, by the way, I've got three bartenders who want to come with me. Or you hire a banquet manager, and they said, I've got five servers who want to come with me. And you've hired the right person when people follow them. And we had that throughout the hotel. So It's a, you know, hire good people, hire the right leaders, hire people who are hands-on. You have to be hands-on. And I think that's the foundation for it. And then yourself, don't be scared to get your hands dirty. Don't be scared to do something wrong, you know. my gosh, if I made a bet, I think our housekeepers would laugh. They would pick it apart and would show me all I had done wrong. But it doesn't mean you can't help.
Well, how do you then keep sharpening the saw? How do you get better at what you do, at your craft? How do you, you've been doing this for so long. I'm sure it feels like there's a plateau, but, you know, what do you do to get better?
Well, I think there's two parts of it. I think the easy part is I'm fortunate enough to be able to travel. And when you travel, you can stay anywhere. You can stay in any category of hotel. There will be something that you see and you think, ah, we were looking for a solution for that, or this is better than what we are doing, or whatever it is. So taking other people's best practices, bringing them back, playing with them, maybe making them your own, changing them a little bit. That's one way I learn a lot of what's happening in the industry. And two, I learn a lot from the people around me. It could be the newest intern that we take out of college. It could be a new manager we've hired. It could be anyone in the hotel. People are all experts at what they do. You know, I can't cook like any of the chefs here. And I definitely can't do anything like the engineers. Believe me, I can barely change a light bulb. But you learn from everyone around you all the time. And you learn from customer feedback as well, right? I think one thing I learned in over the last maybe 10, 15 years is you can't wait till everything is perfect until you do it. Otherwise, you'll wait forever and you'll be the last to do it. Sometimes you've got to take a chance. And if it didn't work, push it to the side and try something new. And so I think sometimes just what you the feedback you get from guests or from your colleagues, and you're like, oh, let's give that a try. We can make this better. And you try it. And sometimes it works. And sometimes you realize that wasn't the right thing to do. And you move to the next thing. Don't be scared of failing at something or it not working, because some things will work and then it will be really worthwhile.
Let's go back to the first part of your answer. What was like a really interesting thing that you did see on one of your travels that like, we're definitely going to do this back at my hotel? That was super, super cool.
I'll give you a bit of a generic answer to that. I think the team probably cringes when they know it's my first day back from travel, because I'll have a little goodie bag full of things I've picked up along the way that I'm like, oh, this was a really fun do not disturb sign. This was a really great little stuffer that was in the check in the bar where I just was. You know, you pick those things up. Obviously, I don't take anything that is of value, but you or it's photos that you're sending along the way, and sometimes you realize it's just something that won't work where you are. But a lot of the times, you file it away for the future. I might one day be somewhere where this is a great idea. I'm trying to think of something very recent that I've bought back that I thought would be a really great idea. Maybe I'll keep thinking about it while you ask your next question, and it will come to mind.
Okay. Well, and then you mentioned you can't be afraid of trying things, because some things won't work, some things will. What's been your favorite? You know, this is really risky, we're going to give it a shot, and it worked.
Well, let me tell you one that didn't, because okay. I think that would be even more fun. I was working at a resort in Mexico. And we thought, you know, when guests have room service, they're not getting the restaurant experience. So let's bring the restaurant to them. And so let's, you know, bring a lot of things that are almost finished, and we'll finish everything off in their room. And it'll be like they're in a restaurant and the food's being prepared in front of them. So it could have been, here are all the ingredients, and we've got this huge bowl, and we're putting your salad in, and we're putting the dressing in and we're mixing it up and doing that in front of you. And there were other items were like, oh, here's at least, 10 items on the menu. Well, what we learned after we tested it for about a month was that if a guest is having room service, that there's probably in a resort like that with beautiful views from the restaurants and beach restaurants and everything, it's either they're really tired, they're working, or they have other plans for the evening, and you hanging out in their room for 10 minutes is really not a good idea. So we tested it for about a month, maybe not quite a month, and we scrapped it right away. We just realized most guests were like, are you going to be done soon? So we had the best of intentions with that just didn't work. But we tried it and we realized it didn't work, and we got rid of it. On the same note, I was in another hotel a couple of years later in Chicago, and we realized that some guests just wanted room service to be a lot less, bother. Maybe a female traveler did not want a male server in their room. And so we said, well, let's give our guests two options. They can have traditional room service, or we'll give them a grab and go. And so in the grab and go, you got everything in a big paper bag, almost like a, I don't know, Uber Eats order delivered, but we put it outside your room. We rang the doorbell and we left, and we would let the guests know it was out there. And when the guest was done, they could just put it back outside and we would go and pick it up. And we actually got pretty good feedback from that. Some people saying, this is good. I don't really like someone in my room, or I have confidential things in my room, or for whatever the reason is. So, sometimes you try things and they work, and some things just don't, and you got to admit it and move on from it.
That's brings up a great point, is how do you balance wanting to service and be there for the guests versus knowing when is it time to, they just want to be there to themselves.
I think you got to just read your guest. I think in my early days in the industry, everything was drummed into you. This is how you do it. And regardless of who's in front of you, whatever it was, if you were, when I was a server in the restaurant, these are the steps you followed no matter what. When you were at the front desk, this is what you did no matter what. And because this is how it's done, and the guest needs to understand this is how it's done. And, fast forward to today. And today, everything should be from what the guest wants. Read your guest. If you have a business man or woman checking in, and it's a good chance they are behind schedule already because their flight was probably delayed or whatever else, do not keep them standing there at check-in for 10 minutes while you tell them all about the hotel. Just ask them if there's anything they would like to know about the hotel and get them to their room as fast as possible. Conversely, if you have a couple or a family checking in and it's the weekend and it's their first time in Boston, you give them the time, ask them what they would like to know about, answer their questions, tell them where there's a great experience. You have to have breakfast in our restaurant because it's a 100-year-old room. Let them know about, and they're interested, but read your guests. Don't insist that the guest follows your procedures. You read your guest and you adapt accordingly. I think that's what you have to do today for everything. You just need to, that is luxury service. You customize your service for the guest.
Any other things to add about what is luxury, the new luxury now, with, all this technology that we have and, AI coming into the picture, and what does luxury look like today?
With all the technology, it can help things. It doesn't mean everyone wants it. And so I think it's all about, again, it's options. Give the guest options. If I want to chat and use that to send my room service meal or ask for something, I'll use it. If I want to call down and speak to a human being, I have that option. If I, give options, use it just as a way to offer a larger variety of service. Don't replace the service. You're just using it. And there's some guests who they've been speaking to people all day. They want to be in their room. They just don't want to speak to another human being. Give them that option. But if they ask somebody, you know, I remember in my previous job for guests that had certain status in a recognition program, they could bypass the front desk for check-in. They could pick their keys up at the doorman. That was great. It was an option. But there were some regulars who said, that's part of my experience. I want to stop by the front desk. I want to say hello to the people I know and give them that option. Do not use the only technology and take away those options from a guest. I think that's what luxury is all about. And I think the other thing is the one thing you hear people never have enough of these days is time. So what can you do to make their time more valuable, or they have more of it, or they decide how to use it? If they're spending a weekend with you, they've chosen to spend 48 hours with you, make sure they leave thinking that was time well spent. Wow, that was a great stay. I don't regret coming to Boston for the weekend. That was, or bringing my family there. This is my time with my family. Make sure they leave with those memories. Create those memories for them. I think that's what luxury is making people feel like they made the right choice and spent their time and their money wisely. But the time part is the part they can't replace. So really, really respect that and make sure you make them leave feeling like they made a good decision.
Well, Michele, I definitely feel like the last almost hour was well spent. I really appreciate you coming on to the podcast and sharing your experiences and inspiring future leaders and just sharing the wealth of knowledge that you have. And just wanted to really thank you for offering your time to be here with me.
Been a pleasure, Brandon. Really has.
Thank you. We will be in touch. And that wraps up episode 2 of Luxury Leaders.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you.